We've been designing our streets under the paradigm that they are moving cars for so many years now that we have a design culture that is just comfortable with those kind of things, and bike boxes and other intersection treatments that are new are sort of unproven in some sense.
What we want to do is never have to ask a cyclist to dismount, and we can't do that today.
Welcome to Habitat on CKDU 88.1 FM. I'm your host, Erica Butler, here with a special Bike Week edition of the show. We have gathered a panel of people involved in biking in Halifax to talk about the state of cycling in the city. So we have with us Hanita Koblenz. Hi, Hanita.
Hi, Erica.
Hanita is the Active Transportation Coordinator at HRM. Is that a correct title?
That is absolutely correct.
All right, awesome. Ben Wedge, who is a co-chair with the Halifax Cycling Coalition.
Good afternoon, Erica.
Hi. And Ben Buchwald, who is the new Blue Route Coordinator for Bicycle Nova Scotia.
That's correct. Hello. Thanks for having me.
All right. Let's just jump right in. Last year at this time, not everyone, Hanita, you were here last year for last year's discussion. There was a lot of talk about the Crosstown Connector at that point. It was even before the decisions had been made. Now we have the Windsor Street Bike Lane. Which got painted, I guess, last fall.
That's right.
Have we been able to judge the success of the Windsor Street Bike Lane yet? What do you think is next for that corridor, and how successful do you think it's been so far?
So I think first I want to say that I think it's a success fundamentally because it's there.
Yeah.
It was a 2.5-year process of a very intense public consultation and internal discussions within city departments and with stakeholders, and it resulted in something on the ground. So that was a big deal, and I think it was our first case study of what is needed to create a bike network in the regional center of our municipality, in that trade-offs are required quite often to introduce bicycle infrastructure into an existing road network where parts of the street are already being used for other things, primarily parking. So it was a good case study, and it helped us as staff develop an understanding of what would be required on a go-forward basis for moving ahead with developing a network. And that was very informative because we've been reviewing our active transportation plan, which was approved by council in 2006, in parallel with doing the Crosstown Connector work. So a lot of that work informed a lot of the recommendations in the AT plan that'll be coming forward very soon to council. So that was very useful. In terms of, you know, typical measures of success, like are there more people biking? Mm-hmm. That's one of the goals of the AT plan, is to get more people biking and give people mobility options. I think it's a little too early to tell because, for one, it hasn't been there long enough. And second, and probably more important, it's not connected to a network yet. And until we have a network of bike facilities, I don't think we'll see lots more people cycling, but I think it has created a much more comfortable cycling environment for those who currently cycle there, and for those new people who will be trying it, and we'll be evaluating it by doing bicycle counts. We did before counts, we did some winter counts, and we'll do some summer counts this year and on a go forward basis to measure those things. I don't know what anyone else thinks. Sorry, I'm a mic hog.
No, don't worry.
Yeah, I guess if I can jump in, from the Cycling Coalition's perspective, the fact that the Windsor Street Bike Lane went in signals a bit of a change of tune at council. And council went forward with this decision, even though there was a fair bit of opposition from people who were uncertain about it. And they said, no, we really believe in putting in cycling infrastructure, so let's build it. And that is really important. There's some things that could have been done better, and as Hanita mentioned, the city's kind of learning. This is their first time going through that process, so maybe the public consultation will be done a bit differently, or maybe some of the other pieces will be there so that we have more success on Hollis and on the future projects that are in that active transportation plan. But really, this is a signal that the city is starting to take a different approach to cycling infrastructure, and we're excited to see where that goes.
And I would echo that sort of sentiment that this is a milestone for Halifax, and it's great to see. That's a success for sure. I think when you talk about the success of the bike lane, it's more than just how many people or how much riders did it increase in Halifax. I think it's really important that we evaluate and study that in kind of a methodical way. So do people feel more comfortable on that bike lane? What's working about it and why? So if people don't feel comfortable, what are the problems? Is it an intersection issue? You know, just getting a little bit deeper under the skin rather than saying, you know, ridership increased on Windsor Street by this much. I think that's an important sort of piece to consider going forward, and that will help us as we kind of plan the complete network that Hanita is talking about, that we really need to raise those ridership numbers in Halifax.
The whole idea of measuring success of bikeways is it is hard. Speaking from someone who's looked for numbers in the past, like there's not a lot of reliable data out there, right? Like even just knowing how many people bike in Halifax on a regular basis is kind of a hard number to track down.
Yeah, and there's different ways of measuring it, right? Like our original AT plan was relying on census numbers for the long form, the mandatory long form census that was around in 2006, which asked the question on the journey to work. Mm-hmm. But in 2011, that was switched to the voluntary National Household Survey, and the data didn't really seem to line up, and officials from the Statistics Canada were saying they're not necessarily comparable numbers, so that's hard to track. Having said that, I revisited some of those census numbers, and it's really interesting. Like in some parts of the Halifax Peninsula, 15% of people report that they bike to work, mm-hmm. in the West End particularly, mm-hmm. which is like bordering on some European cities, like it's not quite Copenhagen or Amsterdam, but it's like parts of Germany like have those kinds of high modal shares of people who bike. So a lot of people do bike, but of course, like in the region, the average is the typical North American average of 1%. It really depends on where people live and where people work in right. terms of commuting, yeah. cycling,
yeah. And that's
whether they'll do it.
And the region yeah. includes rural areas as well,
right,
as urban
which
areas.
Are very low density, yeah. with yeah. very dispersed destinations, and people still ride in those, but it's certainly, mm-hmm. you know, not the easiest or fastest way to get around, mm-hmm. which it can be if you live downtown.
Yeah, and the census mm-hmm. level data makes mm-hmm. it tough to look at some of the other comparable cities that don't have the same rural area. Like it's we're what, 6,000 square kilometers in Halifax? That's unbelievable for a city of our size. I can't think of any of our peers that are in that 250 to half a million population that have that huge rural tract in them. And then you look at our census metropolitan area, and the number kind of is maybe misleading, but at the same time, mm-hmm. you can break it down, as Anita mm-hmm. did, to mm-hmm. those neighborhood levels. And on the peninsula especially, we have really good active transportation. We're number three nationally. There's only Victoria and Kingston that beat us citywide for active transportation, and that's because so many people walk to work in the North End mm-hmm. and downtown, as well as a higher number mm-hmm. of cycling. But as soon as you look at cycling data, we're kind of 17th nationally. So the census is a good way to track overall trends, but the screen line counts that the city's been doing are very important on a local level. And then the Cycling Coalition was working with the city last year to buy the first permanent counter that would go along one of the bike routes and count every bike that goes by and display that data publicly. But the city's kind of in a review of all of their traffic counting technologies, and I don't know if Anita has more information on that today, but
I was hoping you could give me some, actually.
As of kind of late April, mm-hmm. that was still under review, and they didn't want to buy a bike counter that wouldn't fit in with the new technologies that they're hoping to purchase. But yeah. that plan's on everyone's radar, and we had put some funding up to hopefully get that through.
Right, and we were excited to see that you guys come forward with that, because that and you've just reminded me, I think there is I'm not in the traffic department anymore, so I'm not totally up to snuff, but we are reviewing all our signal timings and how our controllers and all that, and and it does make sense for whatever new technology we buy to integrate with that. But in reviewing the literature and talking to people in other places who count cyclists. Like, one of the challenges of counting cyclists, like, we do a biannual screen line count to sort of try to measure and gauge flow of cyclists in and out of the regional center and also across the peninsula. But it's like a one-day count. And the trouble with, you know, that really works for traffic because most people's car traffic patterns are the same from one day to the next. Mm-hmm. And a one-day count can be, you know, could be any weekday of the week could be the same as the next day, and those assumptions can be made. With cycling, it's much different. Like, there's many more things influencing whether or not you choose to cycle, like weather being a big one. So what is really needed in order to make those one, and of course you can't do like multiple day, no one has the resources to station people, you know, on the street counting every single day to get really robust data, but there's technology that can provide, you know, indicators of, you know, if you can get a few places where you have a permanent count, then you can develop factors that adjust for weather and temperature and precipitation, things like that, that you can then apply to your one-day count and, you know, ramp it up or ramp it down as needed to give you comparable data. So we're really in support of the HCC, really excited about HCC's proposal to get a permanent counting system and thanks for reminding me of that, because we really need to make sure that it gets rolled into that other study that's going on and that we find a good place to put that permanent counter.
So just, I mean, I know that we don't want to talk about data all day, but I think it's important to consider that
Geeks.
The census, I mean, bicycle counts are hugely important because they get towards something that the census misses, which is everything other than commuting by bicycle, right? And when we talk about active transportation, commuting is absolutely essential, but it's only a portion. And in fact, when you look at the entire spectrum of what people do, how they spend their time in transportation, it's not even half of what people are doing. So I think there's a huge number out there that we can capture and begin to understand better when we're talking about surveying and kind of studying the population's transportation behavior. It's worth worth thinking about.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because I feel like a lot of the numbers that get thrown around now are, you know, there's cyclists and then there's drivers and then they sort of categorize people, whereas, and I have heard, you know, data presented this way. I think, who was the San Francisco transportation guy that came down like last year?
I forget his name.
He talked about, like, they seem to be, I don't know if they really are, is measuring modal share of trips. So like, they're basically trying to track, like, how many trips people are taking and what the modal share of those trips is. So, I mean, really, and like a person like me who does cycle, and I, you know, maybe on the long-form census I might have said I cycle, but I don't cycle all year to work. So it's like, even answering the long-form census was hard because you just had to be like, well, I guess I'll just throw myself in the cycling camp, I guess. Yeah. But I'm not 100% of the time. So,
right.
But yeah, allowing for that, you know, anyway, allowing for the differences and that kind of gives you the opportunity to show when someone like me increases how much I cycle, say, you know, right. Someone who might have already been counted. Anyway.
Well, if I can throw in a quick final point
sure.
on that. Toronto, since I think 1985, has been doing the Toronto Transportation Survey. And that's a phone survey of a pretty wide swath of Toronto's population to track all of your trips from the time you get up till the time you go to bed and when you make them, how you make them, where you're going, all that stuff. And they have a really big data set. And now with automated phone polling technologies, it's more affordable for a smaller city like Halifax to maybe get into that game. But the most interesting thing I found whenever I looked through that is that even though the public transit and active transportation has been growing in Toronto since the early 80s, the active transportation has been growing, they're cannibalizing public transit and the car rate has been flat. So that's kind of data that we don't really have in Halifax for our overall trip schedule. We just have that census data for commuting to work. But it would be neat if we could have that same kind of data set.
Yeah, that's an interesting point because that's definitely like that's as a user of a transportation system, those are like usually my choices. Like I'm not just going to, oh, it's raining today, I think I'll just go buy a car and start being a driver to work. Like, you know, usually it's I'm choosing between transit and cycling or even other active ways.
Yeah,
so, interesting.
And generally, you have a choice to drive. If you have a car, you can drive from anywhere, whereas transit and cycling are much more dependent on your urban environment and the facilities or services available to you. So it sort of makes sense that they cannibalize each other a little bit.
So we need bike counts to help plan an efficient, you know, practical system so that we can move, you know, we can put the infrastructure in the right spots, I guess. But we also need more information sort of on a macro level. Although I can't believe I'm actually like saying I would like, you know, another robot survey to be calling my house. doesn't sound good. Sorry, Halifax.
So we do have an origin and destination survey planned. I believe it's even budgeted for, but we have been talking about it in the office, and it is going to happen. It's not just for cycling, obviously. It's for planning our overall transportation network.
Oh, that's great. Well, that's the whole point. Yeah.
We do have that on the radar.
Awesome. Just quickly give us an idea of what's happening next in the Windsor Street bike lane. There's going to be
next. I mean, the next piece we really want to do is St. Pat's High was surplused, I think, a year ago now. So it's going through the process of disposal, whether or not it's anyway. There's a whole process
yes.
there. When that was being surplus, because school board properties go back to the municipality, and then the municipality decides whether or not we need them for municipal purposes or community purposes, or they should be released to the market for economic development. Our department reserved we reserved a corridor along the back property line of the St. Pat's High, so that the Windsor Street bike lane, if any of you use it out there, it ends mid-block, like I know many of our bike lanes do, but it ends there on purpose so that we can create a formal path between Windsor and Quingate Place. Most people shortcut through the nursing home property there, which I raced through there this morning trying to get to this interview on time. You know, there's tons of people walking through there, cyclists, there's people mm-hmm. trying to find parking who are visiting their relatives in the nursing home. It's not an ideal situation where like a very popular AT shortcut is cutting through private property. So it's in the design stages now. Our aim is construction this summer. It's not that hard a project. There's an existing driveway. We just need to ramp up, open the gate and better curb cut and sort of think about the transition zone from the path back to the road on Quingate Place. So that connects to Quingate, which leads to Vernon and Seymour Streets, which is a popular existing bike route to the universities, which we'd like to upgrade to a local street bikeway, which is a facility type that we don't have in HRM right now. And it's been used in Vancouver and Portland in particular, and it's basically like signed traffic calmed networks on local residential, usually residential streets for cycling that just help cyclists navigate the urban environment and avoid busy streets. So it's really a great type of facility for new cyclists in particular.
Signed and traffic calmed, so that's that's
signed and traffic calmed if required. Like we would do speed studies and try to you obviously don't want a bike route on a street where people are going 60 kilometers an hour. That doesn't feel comfortable. But if the speed is somewhere between 20 and 40 kilometers an hour, then that's ideal for cars. Mm-hmm. But we wouldn't necessarily traffic calm every street just because it's a local street bikeway. And we are in the process of developing a policy and a framework for how we would designate local street bikeways and how we would improve them and the types of improvements we would consider. And there's a draft of that policy complete. It's actually with our legal department for review, so we're really hoping that is before council before the end of the year, so we can start improving the rest of the Windsor Vernon Seymour corridor.
And I'm just on that idea of traffic calming. I mean, as I understand it, for the people out there who might be listening in and wondering what you might do, yeah, there are sort of physical improvements that can be made. Speed humps perhaps mm-hmm. could be added. I'm not saying that this is what the city has planned for Vernon, but you can add in speed humps to slow down vehicles. You can narrow the vehicle right of way at certain points with various pieces of infrastructure and strategies, but basically trying to get traffic down to those speeds that you mentioned between 20 and 40 kilometers an hour, which is a much safer mixing speed, much more comfortable mixing speed.
Does that mean the range of speed is between 20 and 40, or the average speed is between 20 and 40? Because an average speed of 40 is still pretty fast, is it not? Like that sounds fast to me. No?
Well, the legal limit in the city is 50 kilometers an hour.
Yeah.
And a lot of our streets are wide enough that people are doing that. Anecdotally, the I know Young Avenue had some issues last year, and the police put in a radar detector and checked. But when you have a wide street and low traffic, people can put the pedal to the metal and see how fast they can go. So certainly with traffic calming, you want to get that speed down as low as possible. And the target in a lot of bigger cities is 30 kilometers or less on neighborhood streets. And they do that through the other measures that Ben mentioned. So really designing the street so it's uncomfortable to go beyond that speed in your car. And that's really just through a residential block, getting you to your main road, like Roby Street. And then you can resume going at the higher pace of traffic. Mm-hmm.
And even, you know, beyond the physical things like that, Vernon Street is already, I'm guessing, pretty good in terms of the speed. I mean, it looks like a neighborhood, right? You look like you're in a residential environment when you're going through Vernon. There's houses on either side, fairly dense. The tree canopy is there. I mean, it just doesn't feel like a street that you're sort of speeding down. So I think that that character is also important and can lend itself to traffic calming measures.
Mm. All right. Now, Windsor Street has one of my least favorite intersections in it.
Oh, of course.
So
right.
Let's talk a little bit about intersections.
I don't think you're alone on that, that intersection. I think everyone listening to the program knows exactly which one you're talking about.
It doesn't matter if you take it in a bike, on foot, or in a car. Nobody likes Windsor, so.
Windsor,
no, it's
so
true.
Yeah.
Yeah. Windsor, Kennard, sorry, yeah.
You're talking about, yeah.
Windsor and Kennard. I feel, you know, that a lot of the beginning bike lanes that we had, you know, like Brunswick Street and even the Windsor Street, and even Bell Road, I'm thinking, there's a painted bike lane. Like when I often come off South Park onto Bell Road, and you know, after I'm over the hump of the really difficult part, then there's the bike lane. You know, I often wonder, like, the real problem and the real conundrum for bike infrastructure is intersections, right? I mean, I guess there is definitely the challenge of getting, you know, taking away some space from parking or other activities to allot extra space for cyclists. But intersections really seem to me like maybe the hardest nut to crack. What's out there? Like, I mean, we don't, HRM, correct me if I'm wrong, Janita, we don't have any like interventions or infrastructure for cycling at intersections yet. Do we?
I don't think so.
No.
I can't think of a single example.
No. I guess the one thing is we do have a to Quingate, bikes are allowed to go straight through that intersection, which is sort of not really infrastructure, but...
Yeah.
Yeah. But that took a long time to happen, so I got to say. And I love it, you know. Anyway, but... Okay, so what is out there? Like, give riders an idea of what kind of stuff, you know, is happening in other places that we might eventually see here in Halifax, just to help make intersections safer and more easy to understand what should be happening.
If I could jump in first on that one, there's depending on the intersection, there's a variety of treatments or solutions that are available, and I'll stick to ones that are tried and true in North America because of the car sizes and the road designs, they tend to be similar. There's a good comprehensive guide from the National Association of Civic Transportation Officials out of the States that talks about a lot of these. And there's pretty much any highway engineer group has a set of standards that they can use. But one that we want to see a bit more of and that we could do really tomorrow in Halifax is bike boxes. And that's a painted space right in front of the stop bar, so between the stop line and the crosswalk at an intersection. That allows a bike coming on the bike lane to move over to the left side if you want to execute a left turn, and then that puts you out ahead of traffic and it makes you more visible and safer because you can't make a left turn from the bike lane on the right-hand side of the road.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of an interim step. Whenever you get to putting a bike lane through an intersection, there's better treatments that are there, like a two-stage turn where you go straight through and then there's a waiting area and you make the 90-degree turn and wait for the light to change to green and then you cross the other side of the street. And that works really well when you have a bike lane on both of those streets.
I feel like I do that on streets already, but I just have to dismount and get on the sidewalk.
Yeah, there's kind of some illegal...
It's like sort of, if you're dismounting,
just
use the sidewalk.
Yeah, so what we want to do is never have to ask a cyclist to dismount. And we can't do that today. There's a lot of infrastructure that has to go in. There's a lot of changes. There's a few legal changes that need to be made here. Like the Motor Vehicle Act prohibits some of the stuff we're talking about right now, or at least doesn't explicitly allow it. But we have that Innovative Transportation Act. Is that the correct term?
Yep, I think
Nita's so. It is.
Nodding her head. So because these are tried and true around North America, hopefully we could go to the Minister of Transportation and say, this is a proven concept. Can we have permission through that act to try it out for a couple of years? And hopefully the minister will say yes. I mean, the minister approved Segways going around on city streets as a pilot project. So hopefully they'll allow an engineering intervention that's been proven around the world.
So we're in a situation where the provincial government needs to, what? The provincial government needs to say this is a bike box is a facility that you, the municipality of Halifax, can use? Or can Halifax?
It doesn't necessarily have to approve a bike box, but there's provisions in the Motor Vehicle Act that conflict with what a bike box is communicating to cyclists. So,
in other words,
the requirement to ride as close to the right as possible.
Right.
So, you know, a bike box is great, you know, if there's a red light and you're making a left, you're allowed to move to the left to make a left turn as a cyclist under the Motor Vehicle Act. But if you're not making a left turn, if you go into a bike box and sit in the middle of the lane in order to go straight, then you're violating a provision of the Motor Vehicle Act that requires cyclists to stay as close to the right as practicable. Mm-hmm. So there's some, you know, we still need to, that's our interpretation of it, and you know, the Motor Vehicle Act is a law, and you know, we're reviewing that, and we're gonna have our legal department review it and go over the concerns with the traffic authority provincially, and it's just unfortunately it's like one more thing to do kind of things. Like, we don't have a ton of resources municipally to throw at this kind of stuff, but yeah, there do seem to be some early concerns with the Motor Vehicle Act and some of the innovative interventions, not just at intersections but with bike facilities generally, that are used in other places. And it, you know, we've talked a little bit to some colleagues, and we'll talk more about other colleagues, because what we've also found is that other places, their Motor Vehicle Acts are not substantially different. So we're trying to figure out, well, how did you do it? Or did you just ignore the Motor Vehicle Act, or did you have some special provision? So we're still learning about that kind of stuff.
If I could sort of add in to that, I think the Motor Vehicle Act is important to consider, but perhaps it could become a bit of a scapegoat, because we've been designing our streets under the paradigm that they're moving cars for so many years now that we have a design culture that is just comfortable with those kind of things, and bike boxes and other intersection treatments that are new are sort of unproven in some sense. I mean, we have more and more North American examples which help. But, you know, I know the city is considering a complete streets policy in Halifax, and what that really does is sort of recognizing that streets are not just for moving cars, they're moving people, they're for moving bicycles, they're also public spaces in some right. And so there's an opportunity to use that as a policy to influence our sort of design process and the way that we think of our streets. I think that's equally important to our legislative approaches, I suppose. And then just adding to what Ben was talking about in terms of intersection treatments, I know the bike box is another one, is a great one, good example, but there's also bicycle signal phasing at some intersections. And when I've sort of read research into that, it seems to be one of the most effective treatments at intersections to sort of organize the movement of vehicles and bicycles effectively.
So is that giving bikes a priority signal?
Or a segregated signal where only bikes can move and everyone else has
another,
to
move. Go time for bikes, phase. Then so it's time similar, for cars, then...
Sort of like a blend between you know, your standard traffic signal and your pedestrian signal, for example. Like in Quebec, they have the scramble phasing for pedestrians, where pedestrians can all cross an intersection at any point and at any angle, and all cars stop. Sort of similar with the bicycle phasing, I'm guessing.
Right. So, yeah, I was going to bring up that traffic signals, because I just got a notice, I think a couple weeks ago, the Transportation Association of Canada has been working on a guideline, national guidelines for bicycle traffic signals, and they were just published very recently. So we've ordered a copy. So that that takes care of one hurdle. And it's and the thing with intersections, I mean, you can put as much paint on the road and try to designate areas as much as you can to try to make it safer. But fundamentally, like, most collisions happen at intersections, most mm-hmm. vehicle collisions, ped collisions, and bicycle collisions, because those are that's where the conflict points are. And you know, nothing will, virtually nothing will supersede the need for people to just be aware, follow the rules, be aware of what they're doing and what others are doing. But having said that, if you can't physically separate the uses from each other, you can separate them in time. And that's what traffic signal phasing would allow, would give, one use could be like, you know, you give cyclists a few seconds to clear the intersection before mm-hmm. Before cars mm-hmm. Get in. Yeah. And that's what the pedestrian scramble phasing that Ben's referring to also does. The thing is, though, that you also have to consider is that there are other road users on the street. So, mm-hmm. Signal timings that give a lot of priority to pedestrians, for example. Bicyclists are, I think, less of an issue because they can clear an intersection very quickly. But if you're giving pedestrians like a 20-second phase to cross at an intersection where there's quite often no pedestrians, like, that's not efficient for anyone. It's not good for the environment. It causes congestion and delay and makes people angry. So these are not treatments that just need to be applied everywhere. They need to be applied where they make the most sense.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah.
Yeah, hopefully we have the technology to make sure it's only happening if there's actually people there. Like, yes, that would be, I'm picturing how like a recipe for, like, you know, having people react negatively to your new ideas.
Well, that's just it. You don't want to create backlash by mm-hmm. creating things that really inconvenience and harm others. Like, you mm-hmm. want to strike that balance between giving all road users, feelings of safety and comfort and opportunities to travel efficiently.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of intersections, we're about to, I don't know how close to about to we are, but HRM is seriously considering installing more roundabouts in the city.
That's right.
How is that going to work for cyclists?
If I can take this one first again, it's very situational. Roundabouts really run the gamut. You've got the Armdale roundabout, which is massive, designed for high speed. There's three lanes. The approaches are very wide, very flared. It's how fast can you go through that thing? And even motorists hate it. I would never recommend someone going through there on a bike. On the other end of the spectrum, you have neighborhood roundabouts, which would go on two little neighborhood streets. I'm thinking like Clifton Street and Charles Street, maybe. And you put a roundabout in the middle and you narrow out the intersection, and it's designed to go through very slowly with low traffic volumes. And that's something where your local street bikeways plan will often have those kind of facilities in it. And those are very slow and safe. And then in the middle is kind of what we're looking at on North Park Street. Those two roundabouts are somewhere in between those two, closer to the Armdale end than the little neighborhood ones. But things you can do to protect cyclists: you never want to put a striped bike lane inside a roundabout because cars drift toward the outside. That's just bad. You want to separate them physically, so maybe before the roundabout you divert the cyclist, and that's part of the plan on North Park Street, is to get cyclists onto the commons and taking those great trails, and those will be upgraded, the trails across the commons. So that's another way to do it. And or if it's a smaller roundabout and you have the space, you put the bike lane right beside the sidewalk. So the cyclist goes up and there's basically a second sidewalk, but it's for bikes only. And our Motor Vehicle Act doesn't really allow that right now. So that's another time where we need some change. But it's very situational. And I think Anita and Ben might want to add some items to that.
Well, you did ask, like, you know, are we seriously considering them? And we're very seriously considering them. We'll be starting construction very soon of the roundabout at Cunard Agricola and North Park Street. So the North Park Roundabouts Project proposes that roundabout, as well as replacing, I think, probably everyone's least favorite intersection in town, which is Cogswell Cogswell, North Park, Ahern, Rainey, and Trollope, just at the base of the Citadel.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, by the tennis courts.
My least favorite would definitely be the Willow Tree, which is like also another commons intersection, but that's probably because I use it more.
That you know what? That is a bit bigger and nastier, isn't it? But anyway, the plan is to build the Agricola and roundabout this summer, starting very soon, and it's just too big a job to do it all in 1 year, and do the Cogswell roundabout next year, it's been a very interesting process designing those two roundabouts in the city. I know the Halifax Cycling Coalition feels there's still some shortcomings from the design, but I honestly in the 5 or 6 years I've been doing this job, I've never seen a bunch of road engineers standing around a plan talking about bicyclists so much than during this project. So it really heightened levels of awareness and understanding, and I sincerely feel that designers did try to do their best in terms of accommodating bicycles through and diverting them around the roundabout onto multi-use paths. So you know, no one seemed to feel that the intersections were great and should stay as they are. They're both very compromised for all the road users, vehicles, pedestrians, and cyclists. So, you know, I'm pretty sure everyone will feel there's an improvement with these roundabouts. Mm-hmm. And they're you know, and you talked about Windsor, Cunard, and Chibucto. And you know, that's a really tricky intersection, and it should that should be coming up for review as well. It was the big con in choosing the Windsor Street bike lane, but we were also understood that there was interest in upgrading that intersection, and I'll be very curious to see if a roundabout is possible there, and how that mm-hmm. how that would work, because there isn't a lot of space, and
you have to buy the needs.
There may be some property acquisition required, right? Yeah. It's just there isn't a lot of extra land. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
I mean, Hanita kind of hinted at this when she said it will be an improvement, but I think often you get asked, you know, do you support roundabouts for cyclists, or are they good for cycling? And I think it's all about the context and what it's replacing. If we're talking about the Agricola North Park situation, I think there's probably a good opportunity to improve that with the roundabout facility. It doesn't mean that they're better in all situations or at all intersections, so I think it's very context specific. And then just getting into, again, a little bit more of what we can and what we can't do in terms of our design solutions here. We don't have bicycle crossings, so for a bicycle to remain, you know, to ride through across the street like a pedestrian in a sidewalk. And I think those are important facilities to consider as part of separating cyclists from roundabouts. And they could be huge in terms of improving the connectivity on the commons with our multi-use path systems as we kind of move forward to redesign the streets surrounding it. So I think, you know, a bunch can go into these intersection development questions, and it's just important that we search for the best practices and we apply them as we can. And I think, you know, it's good to see, like Anita said, there were a bunch of designers around talking about bikes in those kind of discussions, and that we are moving in that direction, I think, here.
And you know, some of the reason those discussions were happening were because of things like we've been doing for a while, like the screen line count. Like, we actually had the numbers to say that was actually one of the busiest crossings of our Quinpool Cogswell screen line was at North Park Street. It was always in the top three. We've been doing the count for a few years now, so we could safely say that cyclists were part of the traffic on this street, anyway, I won't comment on, like, I don't know what percentage they are of total users, but they're certainly significant in terms of cycling. Like, that was one of the busiest, most popular crossings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. So basically, we can plan the roundabouts, mm-hmm. you know. It, on the one sense, I think, it's roundabouts are so that cars never have to stop. But the other way to think about it is, like, roundabouts mean that everyone has to yield.
Everyone has to slow down and yield. That's
and
right.
just make sure that yep. they're not about to... And run down someone.
And there's a lot of nuances in the design, mm-hmm. right? Like, there's a lot of places where people have to yield and mm-hmm. use caution and turn and slow and And yeah, that's something I've learned through the process. Like, there's a lot of, you know, there's the center, the radius of the center circle. There's the mm-hmm. radius of the approach lanes, the radius of the exit lanes. Like, all of those subtly influence speed and how users approach the roundabout. So,
Now Ben Wedge, the Halifax Cycling Coalition, this year has sort of taken on. What are we going to call them? We're not going to call it, not separated, not segregated, but protected bike lanes.
Yeah.
That's going to be sort of the main focus of the HEC's campaigning in the next while. Is that right?
Well, we're looking at it. We're definitely starting to move the conversation in that direction. So the Active Transportation Plan lays out, and that's the city's plan, lays out this framework and this idea that we need more active transportation. There's some targets and goals, and we're really talking on the nitty-gritty here. And Halifax is the last of the major cities in Canada to put a protected bike lane in the city. So some cities, it's that there's a they have a river that runs right through the downtown, and that makes it really easy for them. But every other city of at least 250,000 people in Canada has a protected bike lane that goes downtown, and or firm plans to install one. So there's some that will be installing them this summer, and it's a conversation that hasn't started in Halifax. But protected bike lanes are the safest way to move people around, and we're starting to grow that focus. We're seeing more examples of them happening in North America, which has traditionally been the excuse to not do them in Halifax, but now those examples are there, and we know every time a city puts one in, cycling numbers go up, and they go up quickly. So within a year, you see on the lane itself maybe 200 to 400% increase in cycling traffic, and overall cycling traffic goes up because people are trying to, they're seeing a safer way to get to work, a mm-hmm. safer way to get to school.
I'm just thinking for the listening audience if we should explain what protected bike lanes are.
I was just about to ask, what will be protecting me?
It really depends. Again, it's situational. There's lots of options. You could do it so the parked cars are to the left of the cyclist, and then you have a buffer of paint so they can swing their doors open, and then you have the bike lane close to the sidewalk. That's one example.
That's with on-street parking.
That's with on-street parking.
You nestle yourself between the sidewalk and the parked cars.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And the space is clearly marked out for you to do that. You're not trying to squeeze between a car that's parked against the curb. Mm-hmm. Another option is plastic posts, and that's kind of a cheap way. Like, we could upgrade Windsor Street tomorrow with plastic posts at a very low cost. Another option is to move the cyclists up at the level of the sidewalk or kind of off. If you think Dunbrack Street, there's a really wide right-of-way. There's about 5 meters between the curb and the sidewalk, but the bike lane is on the road. So move that bike lane up onto that green space, and then the bikes never have to mix with the cars. There's options with paint, with actual concrete curbs. You can see those in downtown Montreal. Those are just a handful of the options. But it's anything where there's a physical barrier between the cyclist and the moving traffic. And that immediately increases the safety, even just a plastic post.
How close is the city to you know, embracing something like that?
So Ben said that the conversation hasn't started yet. It's funny, but they use the word conversation because last fall Mayor Savage had a conversation, they called it the mayor's conversation on healthy and livable communities, and a lot of kind of stakeholders engaged in health, public health, livability, recreation, you know, came to the St. Mary's Boat Club and had like a big brainstorming session, and the mayor's office wrote a report that came out of that was approved by council in terms of that provided some direction, and one of the key recommendations out of that was that we pilot a protected bike lane in Halifax. So the conversation has begun. And I certainly didn't mean to say
that in the wider public context of showing a project and saying this is one of the. I mean the conversation in that.
That's okay. I just wanted to use that word conversation because Mayor Savage and Council are behind the idea. They're aware of it, and they'd like to see something piloted in Halifax. And we may be able to make some announcements about where we're looking at, kind of pretty soon. Actually, there are some early discussions about where one could go.
It's interesting because I kind of part of me has this hope that if Mayor Savage is like the champion of this thing, that he actually probably stands the best chance of being able to sell it to everyone who doesn't want it. Absolutely. You know, I mean, that's his skill. He got elected in Halifax, so yeah, it'd be interesting to see if we actually have a champion there.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of people that want something like this, and it's not just the cyclists that we have out there today. When you talk to somebody who comes out and they're interested, you know, people talk a lot about the interested but concerned cyclists, and that's all the latent demand out there. And in Halifax, especially in the urban area, there's just so much of that because we have dense communities. They're very kind of walkable, bikeable places. But the big concern is about safety. I don't feel comfortable on my bike out there with traffic. And I think that we've heard that enough now to know that there is fairly broad support for something like this. It's not just coming from a fringe group. There, you know, the mm-hmm. political backing, I think, is starting to emerge. Mm-hmm. At least I like to think so.
Yeah. 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 It'll make your job a lot easier, yeah, Ben. Yeah. Yeah.
And
yours does, too, Anita.
And that's what it'll take, right? Because, you know, if you think a painted bike lane requires some trade-offs with other road users, mm-hmm. a protected bicycle lane requires more space, more significant changes to roads, much more thought to intersections and driveways from a design perspective, because those are all places where the barrier needs to be broken, mm-hmm. and you can have conflicts. So, you know, cyclists and motorists need to be aware of those mixing zones, they call them in the design guides. So, people need to want these because they come at a cost, and not just the cost of building them, but some trade-offs with other road users. But
where
they are
should
incredibly
it,
oh. effective. Sorry.
No, that's okay. Where should it happen first? I'm picturing...
I'm going to jump in right away.
Hollis Street. Well, I mean, Hollis Street, because we've just been sitting waiting for it to happen for so long. So now we're going to up the ante and say, now you have to make it
I don't want to see the city
protected
put
bike
a
lane?
Stripe of paint on the busiest truck route in the city. Trucks mm-hmm. are messy. Trucks are scary. It's a great spot. It's a wide right of way. We're looking at taking away a lane of parking anyway to implement the Hollis Street bike lane. So I think, and I kind of did a quick look with a measuring tape recently, and it looks like you can fit a wide truck lane, a narrower lane to use at peak, and then have it switch back and forth to be parking off peak, and then at least plastic poles. So I'm saying Hollis Street because it's funded and ready to go this summer, and they're about to do a public consultation on how to actually do it.
Actually, Ben, I can respond to the email you've been sending me. Ben's been asking me every month, when is the public engagement going to happen? So we have the public engagement for the Hollis Street bike lane scheduled on June 26th at the Art Gallery of Nova Scotia on Hollis Street. In the lobby. We'll be in the lobby. It's not going to be like a big evening meeting or anything. We're just going to be there with our plans so people can come by at their convenience and have a look, talk to staff, look at the plans, and give us their feedback. So you don't have to come, Ben. I've got yours. and it's going to be from noon until 2 and from 4 until 6 p.m. On Thursday, June 26th. And actually, a little plug for the AGNS, too. They have a two-wheeler exhibit that I think is opening tonight.
Oh,
is tomorrow
it
night.
It'll be tonight because this is airing tomorrow.
Oh, okay, right.
Whoa. We're coming at you from the past. Anyway, this, yeah, Friday night. Yeah.
Right.
Friday of bike week. Yeah.
Two-wheeler exhibit, yeah. Which is an art exhibit about bicycling. So, and there's free admission on Thursdays, so you can come to our public engagement and stay for the evening and have a look at the bike exhibit.
Awesome. Now, will this public engagement, so will there be like now the engineers and everyone's already gone over everything and this is the final plan, and or is this like we still could possibly change this?
It's pretty close to final because there's quite a bit of history to this. In 2011, we implemented the downtown one-way street conversion project, and the Hollis Street bike lane was a part of that. Mm-hmm. But for various reasons, mostly resource related, it's been delayed. So the idea was, by converting several streets to the downtown to one way, we were able to generate more on-street parking spaces downtown, create space for the bike lane that was in installed on Lower Water Street, at least partially. It wasn't wide enough for the whole way. And allow for removing some parking on Hollis Street with roughly no net loss of parking in the downtown. So the plans you'll see are pretty close to being final because we do want to paint them this summer. But obviously we're open to discussion. I know a lot of protected bike lanes in other cities have happened as an evolution with the paint going down first and the protection mm-hmm. coming later. It's not necessarily a bad candidate, but we're so early in the discussion of protected bike lanes here in the municipality and the understanding of how to do them and where they're most appropriate that, you know, I just hate to see the delay of making that space available just because we want it to be better. I'd rather see a protected bike lane go in and then possibly enter the conversation about mm-hmm. Upgrading it.
Maybe I'll put this to you, Ben Buchwald. Mm. Since you're focused on the Blue Route, is there like a perfect corridor for a protected bike lane that could you know anchor the Blue Route somewhere in Halifax?
I think that's a pretty difficult question to answer right now. Mm-hmm. We're really in the early days of sort of thinking about where the Blue Route can go, and maybe later we can talk a little bit more about what the Blue Route is and kind of give people some background on it.
Actually, go ahead right now. Are we ready to
Before we move on, I just want to quickly say I've got nothing against Hollis Street being the first, but I wouldn't mind seeing one here on University Avenue as well, because I think that is a great hookup with our downtown and our corridor, north-south corridor that we've already started to develop. Probably a good opportunity here, and I think it's within the Dalhousie master plan they're considering that as an option. So I wouldn't be disappointed to see one here either very early on.
Here's an amateur, like, non-traffic person question for you all. Has anyone in the world ever used, like, boulevards, like, I don't know what you call those things, medians?
Boston.
For bike lanes? Because I think when I'm on Connaught, I just think, look at all that great space. I could just be in there. But then I also think then I have to like cross a million streets as well. Like, is that a thing that happens?
It is. Boston does it. That's the first example that pops into my mind.
And university made me think of it, Ben.
Yeah, like, yeah, yeah. Right.
Because
median is 15 meters wide.
Yeah, it's big.
So
it's
a lot of space.
Yeah.
University Avenue
it's
is
like a
actually
park,
a good candidate.
Basically.
Yeah, because most of the trees on University Avenue are on either side of the median. And you don't want to take away a 50, 60, 70-year-old tree that's right in the middle of the median mm-hmm. just to make it a little bit better to put in a bike lane. But there's lots of examples of medians in the city where the trees are on either side and you still have 5 or 10 meters in the middle. You could just put a nice strip of pavement and separate the bikes with a different signal phase in that case. But yeah, it's definitely mm-hmm. been done before, and Halifax has a few opportunities where we could pursue that.
So it's not completely silly.
It's definitely not silly.
I don't think it's silly either. But it's just challenging because what do you do at the intersection? Cyclists are in a place where they're not expected, and there's no national design guidelines for putting a bike lane, two-way bike lane, down the middle of a road. And how do we deal with those mm-hmm. questions?
Yeah. And thankfully, there is the NACTO design guide that mentioned earlier that does show two or three different options that are approved for use in the United States around that intersection. And actually, Toronto and Vancouver have, in the past few weeks, signed on to NACTO. So we're presumably going to see some examples in Canada of NACTO design standards.
I guess, and university, I mean, a couple bike weeks ago, maybe it was last year, or was it the year before, they actually did a demo of a segregated bike lane, protected bike lane.
Yeah. With cones?
Just with cones, yeah. I think, yeah.
I think we bought or rented thousands of traffic cones. I was involved with that with Rochelle Owen and the Dalhousie Office of Sustainability. I can never say that word. they coned off the parking for a day, and it was at the end of Switch. It was at the end of the Switch route, so there were a lot of people who got a chance to try it. So that is definitely one option, and Dal has been lobbying and asking for some changes to University Avenue for a while now. So.
Yeah. Let's talk Blue Route for a minute. So, I mean, you know, mostly we focus on the municipal government, but, you know, there are bikeways throughout the province, and it's your job now to sort of sew them together into a beautiful What are you doing?
I think that's a very apt description. So the Blue Route vision is to create a province-wide connected system of bikeways or bike routes. It's not supposed to replace every bike facility that's out there. Not everything will be the Blue Route, but it's this idea that you can create a spine for your cycling network throughout the province with this project. When we're talking about the Blue Route and the type of facilities we might be considering, we're really looking a lot to Quebec, where they have a network called the Route Verte. And there they have over 5,000 kilometers of this connected bikeway system. And basically you can look there and find, you know, maybe three or four different types of facilities. So you have your, you know, on your provincial roads, low traffic roads, you have what's called, you know, a designated bikeway. And what you might do there is just put up a sign that lets people know that this is part of our bike route system. Where you have provincial roads where the traffic volumes are getting a little bit higher, it's important to start considering a little bit of separation. So a paved shoulder route could become part of the Blue Route there. And then another big piece of the network is bike paths. And when we're talking about Nova Scotia, there's really, you know, the abandoned rail corridors, the pieces that are part of our destination trail systems that are emerging around the province right now. We have some Trans-Canada Trail candidate routes in Nova Scotia that we can, you know, start to consider to move forward with something like the Blue Route. And then the fourth is when we're getting into the urban areas is, you know, the standard bicycle facilities that we've been talking about all day. So bike lanes, or, you know, it would be great to see a protected bike lane as part of the Blue Route. I think a big piece is when we're talking about this, whatever facility we have in mind, we want it to be comfortable, something that people feel safe while they're a part of it or while they're on it. And I think, you know, coordinating that is a big part of our job, and working with the province and consulting with municipalities sort of bring the project forward.
Mm. You could mention too that the province bought into this idea in a big way, with the Nova Scotia TIR making an announcement at the Bike Summit last fall that they were going to be the department to lead implementation of the Blue Route. Did I get that commitment right?
You had
right?
that absolutely right. there's been great support from the province so far. And
is it a budgetary commitment as well?
If you wanted to go down that road, I think the way it's being thought of right now is the province is always upgrading its provincial road network. And as different pieces of the network come up for upgrades, if they're necessary to make that part of the Blue Route, if we're talking about a paved shoulder, then that can be, you know, considered at the time if it's sort of planned as part of the network. And I think that's the opportunity that people are talking about right now.
Right.
Yeah, and both the province and the HRM are doing a bit of a job to repave the rural roads. They're adding in paved shoulders, and that's how most of our bike lanes in Halifax are coming in now. So every year the city comes back and says there's more. Well, most of those are, they upgraded the Prospect Road, or they're repaving Hammond's Plains Road this year and putting in wide shoulders and striping it as a bike lane. So those are good facilities, and it'll take a long time before every single road is redone, but with both the province and the city kind of bought into that kind of vision, it'll really help Ben's job.
Yeah, I think beyond the specific facilities, the reason there is so much support for this from the province is there's a lot of broad goals about Nova Scotia that this taps into, right? We're talking about creating an international cycling destination with this. I mean, Nova Scotia, with its coastline dotted with all these really unique villages and different regions, it has an unparalleled opportunity for cycling around, you know, in Canada. I think it's a really great opportunity to develop. So you have your tourism options or your tourism development piece of the Blue Route. And then we're talking about, you know, really raising the profile of cycling around the province, and that can build a culture of physical activity and active transportation. I think we have over 10 municipalities now that have active transportation plans. There are more coming all the time, and the Blue Route can really be a coordinating element for those active transportation plans to connect to each other. So I think for those reasons, you have people like the Department of Health and Wellness who are interested in this. I mean, we know that active transportation is one of the best ways to make people more active. It's part of your daily routine. So there's broad interest there. Tourism is another one that I already mentioned. Mm-hmm. And then we have our sustainable transportation strategy in the province called Choose How You Move. I believe that's the title, if I'm getting that wrong. And that's the Department of Energy, who's starting to think about these things much more comprehensively. And so there's interest in the Blue Route and active transportation there. So again, Anita's absolutely right. There's broad support, but we really do need to continue promoting this around the province so people understand what the opportunity is, what it means to be a part of it, and really how we coordinate this and plan it in the most effective way. And I think that's, you know, a big part of my job is sort of spreading the message and bringing people on board. It will take a lot of partnerships to make this happen. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're talking about over probably 2,000 kilometers to connect every county in Nova Scotia. You know, that don't take that number to heart, but I'm just thinking, like, it can't be much less than that. So.
Yeah. I want to thank you all for coming in today. Another good discussion. Glad to hear everyone's thoughts. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much, Erica.
You've been listening to Habitat on CKDU 88.1 FM, habitatradio.ca, and rabble.ca/podcasts. Got feedback on the show? Call the CKDU feedback line at 494-8041 or email habitat@ckdu.ca or check us out on Twitter at Habitat Radio. I'm Erica Butler. Thanks for listening. Habitat.